This is exactly right.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
This story contains adult content and language. Listener discretion is advised.
I struggle to see this as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde situation of the two faces. You know, one is public facing and is good, you know, serves other people, and then the other kind of lurks about in the dark. I think ultimately people are so complicated. You don't know what's going on behind closed doors. People aren't what they seem.
Meg Edwards lives in Whitechapel, the East End of London. She takes me on a tour of her neighborhood, the same neighborhood where Jack the Ripper murdered his victims.
Thanks. And you're in East End, London. You're in East End, right?
Yeah, East End. So we actually point out the only clue that Jack the Ripper left was right outside this door.
Oh, no,
right? yeah. We kind of fell into a bit of a Victorian crime centre. So this, the bit that's painted grey there, that's where he left his only clue, which was physical clue. An apron that was stained in blood.
Was it a victim was found here or no?
Victim was found around the corner, and then he walked this way, and this is where he left his only clue, and a pretty anti-Semitic message written in blood across the wall. So yeah, this is my home.
I've always loved experiencing a place like this, standing in the spot where one of the stories I've heard about for as long as I can remember actually took place. It truly brings it all to life.
Now, how far is the Jack the Ripper epicenter and where people feel like it's the most important area?
It's right here, right these streets. So that the street that we live on, and then we've got this street, which is an important one. Brick Lane is a couple of lanes that way.
Why did he choose around here?
This is what is fascinating, because this area was a slum. It was a really, really poor area with lots of boarding houses.
So this is City of London. This is not obviously Kensington, Chelsea, or
yeah. You're in Kensington, aren't you? Yeah. Very different, right? Yeah. What are the main differences, would you say?
Less dark alleys. Mm-hmm. And even walking to your flat, I was like, whoa. I was very well aware that I was the only woman mm-hmm. with loads of construction workers everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you ever feel particularly alone in Kensington.
Yeah.
Everybody, we're right off of High Street Kensington, so. Mm.
I also think it's so different here on a weekend, because this is the financial district just in there.
Yeah.
So during the week, there are lots of white men in suits walking around. And then on the weekend, not even a coffee shop is open.
This is also the same neighborhood where John Tall spent much of his time. There was a Quaker meeting house nearby, and there was also the apothecary where Tall bought medicines and poison. And it was also home to the coffee shop that he headed to the morning after he murdered his mistress, Sarah Hart.
It wasn't unusual for people of higher standings to come around this area. But there was a massive contrast between the intense poverty that was around here.
Why would the Quaker Meeting House be there?
So the Quaker Meeting House was originally somewhere else, and then during the Great Fire of London, which was 1666, something like that, it was burned down along with, you know, a large percentage of London. And then it moved to, they got a bit of money, and they set it up here. I don't know why they set it up here. Hmm. Quaker community obviously was very small, and it was shrinking as well in John's time, which is perhaps another part of where his arrogance came from, thinking that he was one of the few important people, and that he could never be banished because the pool was shrinking quite significantly, and they were concerned about that.
Meg and I worked to find each of the old addresses, starting with the Quaker Meeting House.
What do we think?
It was literally where we are standing now, but I'm just trying to cross.
It's the Quaker's house, you
yeah,
think?
So it was literally across the road from where he...
Can you Google how old it is? Do you find it?
Yeah. I'm just intrigued whether that was there at the time.
Okay, so this was here. So he ran right over here. He walked over here.
This was the meeting house.
Oh, wow. So you think it's right here?
Devonshire.
Then the apothecary.
Right, so if we turn left, just across here, will be where the apothecary stands. So it is this building here, opposite Boots, the one just here, is where the apothecary was.
So wait, in here?
Yeah. No, the brand new swanky building there was where the apothecary was.
Okay, into the picture.
89 Bishopsgate.
And then the coffee house. Remember, the morning after the murder, after he had taken the train from Slough to central London, this is where he had come.
His, the Jerusalem coffee house, which is where he went to a lot, is kind of in that cluster of buildings there. It's not there anymore, but it was down an alleyway. So that's where, apparently he was quite a lonesome person in there. It was a lot of people meeting and chatting and doing business, and he would kind of sit on his own, read his papers, show face a bit, which doesn't surprise me, actually.
And this is where the Metropolitan Police finally tracked down John Tall in 1845.
It's reminiscent, especially being around this area in Whitechapel and East London of the time. It's just before Jack the Ripper. It's got very weirdly Sweeney Todd vibes. He definitely does. He does become part of that wider narrative of seemingly trustworthy men who, in the shadows and in the dark, do very bad things.
Police in London in 1845 accused John Tall of murdering Sarah Hart, the mother of his two children. They said that Tall left her on the floor of her cottage in Salt Hill, dead from prussic acid poisoning, while their son and daughter slept in the next room. John Tall had almost escaped on the train from Slough to Paddington, but the police were able to receive his description thanks to the electric telegraph. And now that man, who professed to be a pious, devoted Quaker, was in jail awaiting trial. His defense attorney was a man named Fitzroy Kelly. You'll hear more about him shortly. As Kelly met with his client, he explained to Tall that doctors had found a fatal dose of prussic acid in Sarah Hart's body, that they knew he had bought two bottles, and he had brought them with him to Slough the night of her death. That seems pretty damning. I asked author Carol Baxter if Tall immediately confessed at that point.
Oh, no, no, not at all. He pleaded not guilty to the crime.
So there would be a murder trial, a very famous one because it featured the details of an illicit affair, illegitimate children, a double life, and an unwanted, troublesome lover. The Victorian press loved it. I asked crime historian Angela Buckley about how the trial would be conducted.
It was actually tried in Aylesbury as part of the assizes, and they were the biggest regional courts.
Would this have been a jury trial?
Yes, it would have been a jury. So they took place twice a year in the county town.
So they only meet twice a year to do trials?
Yes, yeah, right? Yeah.
Do you just sit in jail for 6 months if you're unlucky?
If you're unlucky, yeah. It's usually crime? They usually took place in sort
days
of
after.
Yeah, March and October. So if you were, yeah, absolutely, you'd be, yeah, completely.
Good word.
As the prosecutor and the defense attorney reviewed the case, each side had to pick a strategy. The Crown believed that it had enough evidence to prove that Sarah Hart had become a threat to John Tall's life as a Quaker. She had demanded more money, more time, and she was tired of hiding in a cottage. The narrative was compelling, But Angela Buckley says that this was essentially a circumstantial case.
I'd say it was pretty typical in early policing and in detective practice at the time. There's very much the reliance on circumstantial evidence, particularly things like his clothing. Also, I read that they found some burnt paper with his handwriting on, some Bible verses in Sarah Hart's cottage. The witness statements, they're absolutely key to policing at this time.
So this was becoming a stronger case, even without a witness who saw him pour the poison in his beer.
You know, they knew about his movements. The presence of the prussic acid, which seems to have eventually been conclusive.
But the chain of custody of that poison was a problem. How to prove that he gave her the poison, that she didn't just take it herself?
Of course, without DNA testing or modern methods, there is actually no proof of him putting the poison into the receptacle and handing her the poison chalice, as it were.
Fingerprints on the beer glass might have been useful, but fingerprinting would not be used in forensics for another 20 years or so. Even then, John Tall could claim that he and Sarah did drink together, then he left, and then she took her own life. Prosecutors struggled to piece together the case, and the huge amount of media attention didn't help. The press was enamored with the story.
I think because of who he was, because he was well known in terms of that he was middle class, you know, had he been a guy from the slums somewhere that nobody knew, you know, in the middle of London, nobody would have ever found him. But the fact that he was known, he was a respected, you know, man in his community, he was a member of the Quakers.
And true crime was big news, especially in the 1800s.
This is unusual, this kind of crime. And it was all very much sensationalized by the press. But yeah, I think people lived in a state of fear. So, you know, that didn't help.
As John Tall sat in court, he listened to his defense attorney, Fitzroy Kelly. Meg Edwards says that Kelly was clever, and he would likely be a good asset for Tall.
Fitzroy Kelly is John Tall's defense lawyer. He is also a Tory politician and a judge. He was well-respected. He was quite on the scene, as it were.
Kelly assured him that all of the Crown's evidence was circumstantial and weak. He said they couldn't place the prussic acid with him directly.
They found it in her body. They didn't find it in her home. They didn't find any on him.
The Crown called several witnesses to the stand to fit its story that Tall carried poison to Sarah Hart's house that day.
They had the report from a pharmacist that he had come in on that day. Again, identified because of his Quaker attire. They had the report from the pharmacist that he'd gone into the pharmacy that day and got a vial of prussic acid. He went into the pharmacy again the next day and said that he had dropped and broken it and got another one.
A friend of Sarah Hart's also took the stand. That friend told the court that several months before, Sarah had been sick after drinking porter after a visit from Tall. This revelation was startling. Still, his wife, Sarah Appleby, stood by him. And that brings us to another question about his first wife, Mary. She was dying of tuberculosis, and before Tall hired Sarah Hart, he himself was treating Mary. I asked Tall's great-great-granddaughter, Hillary Fox, if she had ever been suspicious, considering John Tall's history.
You were saying a couple of things about that I had not really heard. You thought that there was research that the potential was that he might have wanted to rid himself of Mary?
Well, it's only that there are hints about it in various research because she became ill and he was treating her. She wasn't Quaker, which is what he wanted in the end. So he may have been giving her completely the wrong things. We'll never know about that.
Hillary's theory could be true. Perhaps he really did have an affair with Sarah Hart before Mary died. John Tall was sneaky and opportunistic, for sure. But he also brought Mary back and forth between England and Australia when he didn't have to. Crime historian Nell Darby has studied the case. She says that John Tall seemed to really love his first wife.
When she died, there was a notice in the Quaker publication where I think he wrote it.
Tall wrote in the death notice that Mary had put up with a lot from him.
He's had this stressful life, not through any fault of her own, but because he's put her through all this stress and she stuck by him and kind of supported him. Mm-hmm. And it's unusual for me to read something that's kind of seems so genuinely moving. So either he was a very good actor or he did have a lot of love and respect for her, but then obviously didn't find that again afterwards.
By the time John Tall married Sarah Appleby, he was several years into his affair with Sarah Hart. So he might have been happily married to Mary, but he was never faithful to his second wife. Despite it all, Sarah Appleby must have really loved him, or at least she was a steadfast Quaker who demonstrated the Quaker tenets that Tall never did. After the Crown prosecutor concluded his case, Fitzroy Kelly stood up from the table.
So if I were him, or if I were the defense attorney, I would say, even if they were able to prove that, I would say, she asked me to get it for her. I have no idea why. You can't prove that I put it in her drink or did anything. I had just told her I was never going to marry her. I also told her I wasn't going to be able to give her any more child support. She was suicidal. I left, and that's the last time I saw her. That's the perfect defense. You cannot disprove that in any way. There's no witnesses.
Absolutely. And the fact that he was dressed in his Quaker garb, he was going out, you know, in daylight. It wasn't like he was going there at 10 o'clock at night when no one was around.
He
wasn't sneaking around. He had the money on him. There was a very strong defense if Fitzroy Kelly had used it.
But Kelly didn't use it because John Tall had changed his story to investigators.
Now, John Tall didn't help himself because he did end up admitting to having been at her place that day and that she took something. He said she took something and threw herself on the ground and he left in shock. So he probably shouldn't have made that admission.
There wasn't much of a defense, really. But they still had to kind of prove or try to prove that he had committed the murder.
Now, Fitzroy Kelly had to explain how Sarah Hart got that prussic acid in her system because Tall says that he never gave her any of it. That would have been suspicious.
Well, that was admission made under the other lawyers who basically skedaddled when they realized it was going to trial. It is rather extraordinary that this man who was so highly esteemed should make such a poor showing in terms of the defense.
Here's why Carol says that Fitzroy Kelly did not do well in court. He had to admit that Tall was in the cottage, but admitting that Tall gave her the prussic acid would have sealed his client's fate. So how did she get it?
She had eaten apple pips, which contain...
These are apple seeds for Americans.
Sorry, apple seeds for Americans. the things you find in the core of an apple. That's what she'd... They contain very, very small amounts of cyanide. And that she had eaten enough of them to kill herself.
What? She took her own life by eating apple seeds? I asked poison expert Dr. Neil Bradbury about all of this.
Cyanide is obviously a favorite of Agatha Christie and is something that I think most people have heard about. Interestingly, most of us eat cyanide every day. Cyanide is found in apple pips, for example, and any time we swallow apple pips, we are ingesting a small amount of cyanide.
It turns out that this story is famous, not just because of the Telegraph. It's famous for Fitzroy Kelly's dubious defense.
There is a story that is associated with a defense lawyer who used that defense that the murder victim had in fact died not from poisoning and being poisoned with cyanide that had been put into a beer bottle, but had in fact inadvertently died from eating apples and swallowing the seeds of apples.
That might make sense. Most people would have apples handy, and if Sarah Hart knew that eating them might have been fatal, she could have consumed them out of despair, I suppose. This defense could have created reasonable doubt, but Neil Bradbury says that, no, the apple pip defense was not reasonable at all.
It was determined that you did need several thousands of apple seeds or apple pips to succumb to cyanide poisoning. The defense attorney at the time was Sir Fitzroy Kelly, who after this case became known as Apple Pips Kelly for his failed defense of his client for cyanide poisoning.
Apple Pips Kelly, what an embarrassing nickname for an esteemed attorney. Anyway, the discovery that it would take thousands of apple pips to kill Sarah Hart might have sealed John Tall's fate.
It just made a laughing stock of the case a little bit, which is a shame because I think up until that point, just on paper at least, not judging on John Tall's character or how he appeared in court, it was fairly tight. I think there was every chance that he could have got off with it.
Both John Tall and his attorney might have doomed him. He didn't take the stand because the law in those days forbade accused persons to testify on their own behalf. It was assumed that they would say anything, including a lie, to secure an acquittal. Fitzroy Kelly finally reached the end of his argument. He hoped to leave the jury with feelings of empathy for John Tall. He read aloud a letter written from John Tall's wife to him the same day as the murder. Sarah Appleby wrote, "My loved one, the year has opened with a lovely day. I hope it is an omen of the future which awaits us." Fitzroy Kelly scanned the jury and asked, "Could any man, after receiving such a letter, commit an act which would make his wife a widow?" Now, each side had rested their case, and the question to the jury seemed simple. Was Sarah Hart's death the result of suicide or murder? The jury discussed the case and quickly reached a verdict. John Tall stood at the table as the judge read it aloud. He braced himself. He seemed concerned. Was it murder or suicide? "Murder," said the jury. John Tall had killed Sarah Hart on New Year's Day in 1845. John Tall was shackled and taken away to await the gallows. Murder was an automatic death sentence, and there was little hope for Tall now.
He is found guilty and sentenced to death. And because there is no criminal appeals court, the only thing they can do is petition the Queen.
Do they do that?
They do. His defence barristers petition the Queen. The Quakers petition the Queen. Even the foreman of the jury petitions the Queen for not the overturning of his sentence, but reprieve to life transportation. They were happy to send him out to the colonies and dump their problems on the colonies. Send him back where he came from.
Just like they did when he forged that check decades earlier. So did they set aside the death sentence?
Despite money and power, the fact that he was a returned convict probably told against him. So there was going to be no reprieve. And one has to question whether an ordinary citizen might have had a better result from all his petitions, or all the petitions sent in his name.
His track record was objectively bad. He was not someone that the Quaker Church or the British upper-class Victorian society wanted to put on a pedestal. That track record probably led to a bit of an assassination of character in court. That, paired with the unfortunately ludicrous defence that ended up being the Apple Pip story, made the circumstantial evidence seem overwhelmingly compelling.
John Tall had proven that he was not able to be reformed. Behind the mask was hidden a selfish coward, a monster who murdered the mother of his children. But that revelation seems unbelievable to some current members of the family, like Hillary's twin brother.
The whole thing's circumstantial. I do think that there's some whispers in the family now that he was innocent.
Hillary's brother has been suspicious of the verdict because something interesting happened after the verdict. John Tall reportedly confessed, but it was never made public.
I'm not sure. He's convinced that because there was never a confession publicly found, because the man he wrote, whatever he wrote down to, prison chaplain, would never hand it over.
The only thing that we have are newspaper articles, a number of them, which say that John Tall wrote a full confession admitting to the murder of Sarah Hart and also the attempted murder of Sarah Hart 3 months earlier in September, that he gave this to a reverend just before he was hanged, and it was his only wish that this was not released to the public. And the reverend, for one reason or another, abided by that, John's wishes. It was never released, it was never shown, no one knows where it was. It's supposedly a written confession.
Hilary Fox's brother says that a public confession instead of a rumored private one could actually have convinced him of John Tall's guilt, because aside from that, the evidence wasn't all that compelling. Hilary disagrees.
There may have been a question about maybe he didn't do it, but I'm afraid the evidence is pretty conclusive. I think he admitted it to Sarah. At least she, when he was found guilty, she realised that he must have done it, and it was of great shock to her because she stood by him all the while.
His wife, Sarah Appleby, was obviously stunned. How could she accept that her husband not only had a mistress, but also had children with her and then killed her? And then she had to deal with the realization that he had planned it. Angela Buckley and Meg Edwards say that would be hard for a wife to accept.
I kind of think as well that if he'd gone there and they'd had an argument and suddenly he'd been triggered more, I don't think he would have poisoned her. I think he would have hit her over the head with something or grabbed a sharp knife.
But he didn't. He premeditated her murder. He must have hoped that would mean it was less detectable. Either way, whether he had committed violence through force or through poison, this was a case of domestic violence.
And there are so many of those in the 19th century, and I've studied many of them, and it's very rare poisoning case. They're usually a razor, a knife, a hammer. I mean, horrible cases, but it's usually whatever is to hand is the murder weapon. It's very unusual for it to be poison because that's just hard to do, isn't it, on the spur of the moment?
Well, I don't think it was a moment of madness. I don't think it was descent into madness. I think it was almost like a business transaction. She no longer served a purpose to him. She was getting a bit too dangerous. The thing that made most sense to him was to get rid of her. I think that he thought he'd be able to slip away into the night and never be found again.
But it's this explanation that makes John Tall so much more sinister. We all lose our temper. We all act towards people in the heat of the moment in ways we regret later. But very few of us coolly concoct a plan to take someone out, prepare each step, and then actually go through with it. When John Tall killed Sarah Hart, he had revealed the kind of person that he really was and likely who he had always been, no matter what kind of clothes he wore. On March 28th of 1845, John Tall was led to the gallows before a crowd of more than 2,000 people.
The lead up to the gallows, the jail governor said he was the most extraordinary man. They all ended up loving him in the jail, which is against it. I guess it comes back to that charm question which you raised, which I'd never really thought about before.
People liked him.
He had something in him that meant people liked him, and he was very kind to everyone, and he thanked people, and they really wanted him to get a reprieve because of this.
He never referred to Sarah Hart's death while he was in jail awaiting execution.
It's as if he had the ability to push that sort of thing completely aside and keep on with his life. It was very strange.
As John Tall stood on the platform of the gallows, overlooking the large crowd, he began to whisper to the executioner.
When he was up alone on the gallows and wanting to pray, and the executioner just kept him, lifting him up and said, no need for that at this point. And he was trying to drop and pray and raise his hands to the pray, and he was crying out to God.
Tall's vulnerability seemed to incense the crowd.
It was awful, absolutely awful. So the executions in those days were called the hanging matches. It rather reminds me of the movie Hunger Games. Everyone went to watch these hanging matches from all over the country. It was their live entertainment, reality TV show.
So what did they want to see?
They wanted a good execution. They wanted someone tough. They wanted someone make these, you know, throwaway humorous lines to the crowd. Or they wanted them to confess. Or they wanted something. But instead they had this tiny man there trying to pray, you know, beseeching God to forgive him and all of that. And then, of course, the execution itself didn't quite go to plan.
That's an understatement. When the hangman was given the signal, he released the platform beneath Tall's feet and he dropped. But not far enough.
So the length of the rope was wrong, all the calculations were just a little bit off, and what should have been a very quick method of death became quite the public spectacle, which it was certainly set up for as well. There were lots of people in the square, and it took a very long time for him to die.
John Tall was swinging below and struggling to breathe.
I think people were pulling on his legs in the end just to do him in.
It choked him to death.
It did.
For sure.
Which is horrific. Absolutely horrific. Not what anyone deserves, obviously.
Even so, after an extended time, John Tall was finally dead. It took a while for him to die, just like Sarah Hart's painful death by poisoning. Ironic. The legacy he left behind is complicated. He had a successful, productive life in a penal colony, an unlikely place for anyone to thrive. Tall started the Quaker community there, which inevitably helped so many people. He created much-needed pharmacies. He expanded his businesses. He helped create a supportive community. And yet, John Tall was a killer, a shyster, a cheater, maybe not a bad person to the core, but someone who consistently did bad things while simultaneously aspiring to appear pious. He supposedly confessed to a reverend before his hanging, trying to atone for his sin, but he was shunned by the Quakers at the end. They had no empathy for him. I asked Gerald Fox about that confession, the one that was never made public.
Maybe he had a conscience?
Could have been a conscience, but I don't think when people get into that state, they have a conscience. I think they're just single-minded and they just focus on what they're doing without realizing the consequences of people around and the effect other people seeing it. When you tell one lie, you end up with dozens of lies to cover the lies that you've covered in front of it.
Yeah.
And so it goes on. It's a very, very difficult thing to analyze.
Meg Edwards also considers John Tall a bit of a mystery.
I don't believe that he was calculating from such a young age to see the only thing in Quakerism is a good cover. I think it was a way of life. I think it was something that really appealed to him. Increasingly, as the years went on, it started to twig a little bit that actually this is quite a good cover for certain things.
Meg Edwards thinks that John Tall's story is worth remembering, even if it ended sadly for so many people.
He was almost definitely, well, in terms of being caught, the first Quaker to commit a murder. So this just wasn't something that was seen before him. So I think there was definitely an element of arrogance in him that this was gonna save him.
The life of a man with a double life is always complicated and often ends in misery. Was John Tall drawn to the Quakers for redemption of a troubled soul? Or were they protection for an evil heart? Hilary Fox and Meg Edwards aren't sure.
I think he was a very complicated, multifaceted character. I really do. Maybe the poverty he was born into, not having guidance when he was young, who knows? But it is a shame because he didn't need to do all this poisoning. It was a great shame, really.
It is such an interesting thing that he's so self-sabotaging all the time. And he makes the same mistakes over and over again. And I think that's best shown in the fact that this, wasn't the first major crime he committed. I don't think it's reasonable for us to say that he was entirely driven by business and entirely driven by things that made sense to him, because a lot of his actions don't make sense at all.
We will never know what John Tall was thinking during all of this. But Sarah Hart's murder sped up the use and presence of a technology that would later become essential in society. So there was a broader cultural silver lining that comes out of this story. But Sarah Hart's life certainly wasn't worth sacrificing. And there's more than one victim in this story because her murder had a ripple effect across both families.
There's more than one victim in this story. There's a whole host of victims, his children as well. And then those ripple effects that go throughout society of the people who have to look after the children who are left behind. And then that generational trauma that kind of passes down through the families. Sarah Hart, she's a voice that's been lost. There's no way of finding that back, apart from clawing back things like her writing, filing an official, you know, that's a tiny glimpse of the kind of person that she was. And I think reframing the narrative to recognise the women who were victims of domestic violence is incredibly important, but is a very, very difficult task.
Sarah Hart had spent almost a decade living in the shadows with her children, probably partially ashamed and likely very angry. When she finally demanded more rights, John Tall killed her. Meg Edwards says that clearly Sarah deserved better.
I can't help but think she had a really sad life. I think aside from the murder, she gave up everything to be the other woman and to be the secret woman and to sit at home all day with two young children waiting for this man that presumably she trusted and presumably she loved to come and make sure that, you know, she's taken care of emotionally and financially. I think that's a very sad life. She was clearly a savvy woman and someone who had a self-respect to want more for herself, and that was completely ripped from her.
Meg believes that Tall's wife, Sarah Appleby, likely suspected that her husband was guilty.
She stood by his side, but judging by her later actions and also from all accounts the kind of person that she was, I'm leaning towards the fact that she knew that he did it and that she was doing what she needed to do as a wife to stand by her husband. But I think she knew. I think she knew he was guilty.
Hillary says that Sarah Appleby was an extraordinary woman, especially in contrast to her husband.
Obviously not proud that he's a relation, but he was just a relation by chance. And the other side of the coin with Sarah's family, they were very honest, God-fearing people and made good after the hanging, moving to a new area. And she set up her eldest son with a farm and they all lived there, and all the descendants worked hard, did well and were honest and lived as Quakers should. So
he didn't seem to affect, obviously there's shame and the loss of a father and the loss of a husband when this happened.
Yes.
But ultimately, his wife and his children moved on and created their own success.
They didn't. She must have been a very strong woman. She didn't let it blight her life. She was a canny lady. She invested it well. That's how her family after that thrived.
I love finding the good in these stories, the good people who ultimately do the right thing. And luckily, we have one, Sarah Appleby Tall.
So Sarah Tall financially supported the two children, Alfred and Sarah.
Meg says that Sarah Hart's daughter died at a young age, but Alfred was last seen on the census as being 16 or 17.
She sent them money for the rest of their life, which is, I just feel very sad about that. To have her life was undoubtedly completely turned on its head, to be walking around with a convicted murderer and a hanged murderer as your husband, and then to go out of your way to pay for his illegitimate children to, you know, not be lost to history or sent to a workhouse or worse in those days is amazing.
It's an extraordinary bit of history because there just aren't very many people who would do that. And what a wonderful foundation for the family to be built upon.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's where the fascination and the separation of this story for the family now comes from, in that he was one, pardon the pun, but he was one rotten apple amongst a bunch of probably genuinely very good people, very philanthropic people. And devout Quakers as well, not just opportunists. And I think that those qualities immensely outshadow the murder and the darkness that he brought there.
Thanks for listening to this season of Tenfold More Wicked on Exactly Right. We're going on hiatus, but check back next Monday for the trailer for our new season of Wicked Words. As always, thanks for coming back each week. We love our listeners. If you love a good, real ghost story, my audiobook, The Ghost Club, is available wherever you get your audiobooks. I can't wait to tell you the real story about the world's most famous ghost hunter, who was the head of the world's most famous ghost club, and how he investigated England's most famous haunted house. Please also check out my book, All That Is Wicked, which is a deep dive into the criminal mind. This has been an Exactly Right Tenfold More Media production. Producers Jason Whaling, Alexis Amorosi, and Natalie Wren. Editors Jason Whaling and Kate Winkler-Dawson. Researcher Kate Winkler-Dawson. Sound designer Eric Friend. Composer Curtis Heath. Artwork by Nick Toga. Executive producers Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tenfold More Wicked and on Twitter at Tenfold More. And if you know of a historical crime that could use some attention, especially if it happened in your family, email us at info@tenfoldmorewicked.com. Follow Tenfold More Wicked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen so you don't miss an episode. If you like what you hear, rate and review the show.